Hello, everyone, and welcome back to your regularly scheduled true crime portion of Blood and Guts. We have officially exited Catastrophe Month, and you may be wondering, Sarah, what were you doing when Genesis was off on her month-long Big Kitty Passion Project? Were you bettering the podcast in any way? Were you, like, updating the website? Were you writing cases? Were you just, like, being the hard worker that you are? The answer to all those questions is no. It's not I should have been, but regardless, I wanted to come back with a bang. I wanted to come back to the podcast with a big case, and so we're gonna do a case today that is much more like our namesake, very bloody and gut-wrenching, really. So today we are talking about someone who is widely viewed as America's first female serial killer. Now, I don't know if that's true. I don't think it's true, because when I googled first female serial killer in America, another name came up that wasn't her. So we're just going to go with it. But she's also dubbed the Damsel of Death. Today we're talking about Eileen Wuornos. And let me tell you, as a relatively, I would say, new podcast, I mean, we're only about 30 episodes in and we still have a relatively small audience. I have yet to have a case like really get after me, like really affect me. And that's true with like other cases that I listen to on other podcasts. This one was a lot for me to cover. It was like a headspace that was in. It was a mindset that I was in. And I am really anxious to be rid of this mindset. So let's talk about it. So a couple trigger warnings before we start. As per usual, we have abuse. There's sexual assault in here. There's sexual abuse. And I'm going to put an incest trigger warning, even though it's extremely brief. But it's there, unfortunately. So Eileen's story begins June 3rd, 1954, actually in Rochester, Michigan, which I didn't know. As a Michigan-based podcast, not one I like to tack on to our state, but oh well. So only 14-year-old Diane Wuornos married only 16-year-old Leo Dale Pittman. We're starting off strong with child marriage.
Romance.
Yeah, we're starting
off. This is what Olivia Rodrigo wrote about.
This is not what Olivia Rodrigo wrote about. Absolutely not.
It really is brutal out here.
Let me read the next sentence. So Diane thought she was falling for, you know, this charming older boy, but very soon after the marriage, Leo became actually very verbally and physically abusive.
Wait, that's not why I'm laughing. I didn't know what word you were gonna say when you had to like take a moment to figure out, and I thought you were gonna say that he became extremely fertile. Like that's the vowel that exited your mouth at first before you said verbally, and I was like, what does this have to do?
What does this have to do with anything? Yeah, Leo's terrible. Diane, she tried to stick with the marriage the best she could. Obviously, we know there's a lot of psychological reasons why someone would want to stay with their abuser. But also at this point, I mean, it's the 50s. There's a big stigma around divorce. So that's also probably a contributing factor. But then March 14th, 1954, they had a son. His name was Keith. Not much about Keith, just he's important for later. So Keith was born then, and less than a year later, Diane became pregnant again. It was at this time that Leo's very cruel nature was made shockingly public, as he was actually convicted for raping and, I believe, attempted murder of a 7-year-old and, you know, suspected in the murder of another child. So we went like real bad, real fast.
This is not what Olivia Rodrigo wrote about.
Yeah. He was previously diagnosed with schizophrenia, and after less than 2 years of marriage and 2 months before their second child was born, Diane filed for divorce from Leo. Then, February 29th, 1956, Eileen Carol Pittman was born. Eileen never knew her father, as he was in jail at the time of her birth, and he actually hanged himself in prison on January 30th, 1969. End of Leo. So, January 1960, Diane was really struggling as a single mother. She was still living in constant fear of Leo, even though he was gone, and just, like, persistent feelings of just worthlessness. She probably unconsciously, like, instilled in her children. When Eileen was almost 4 years old, Diane actually abandoned her and her brother and left them with their maternal grandparents, Lori and Britta Warnos, who legally adopted them on March 18th, 1960. Now, I believe they didn't know that this was going to happen. Like, this wasn't some agreement. I think Diane just dropped them off and, like, left. I'm assuming that's what happened. But Eileen and Keith had been told that Lori and Britta were their real parents and that Diane was actually their sister. So Britta, who I was confused, so I'm just going to say it. Lori is the grandfather and Britta is the grandmother. I was confused because it's because those sound like pretty feminine names, but just to clear up that confusion. Britta was an unemployed alcoholic, but she...
That sounds like a job to me. I think she's employed.
But actually, she really actually doted on Eileen and they became very close. Like, they had a very close relationship. Lori, however, was very much like Leo in the sense that he was also physically abusive and a drunk. It is also believed...
I could have told you that.
Yeah, that
Sigmund
that
Freud is turning on a spit in his grave. He's getting spun around like a rotisserie chicken at Kroger. This man gets no rest. No rest ever. Evenly baked Sigmund Freud.
Evenly baked Sigmund Freud. It is also believed he sexually abused Eileen from a young age, just to put, you know, the cherry on top of the cake. Eileen and Keith were absolutely inseparable, which it's a very bad thing later on. In school, Eileen was very shy. She was actually too shy to introduce herself to her classmates. And at recess, she sat behind the school, sort of watching all the other students play. According to a former classmate, Eileen seemed very afraid and withdrawn, though she was very temperamental. She frequently lashed out at students she thought were ignoring her, which only, of course, further isolated and frustrated her. And several mental health professionals have since guessed Eileen suffered from borderline personality disorder, which is often actually a byproduct of child abuse. This is just their, you know, sort of hypothesis on, you know, what was going on. Now, on the outskirts of the town Eileen lived in, which I believe was, like, close to Troy, like, Rochester in the Troy area, there was a wooded area containing three small lakes known as the Pits. Teenagers in Troy... Yeah, the ominous. Teenagers in Troy would often go there to party and dig out, like, bonfire holes while getting drunk.
Oh, yeah. Partying like, the Pits.
Yeah.
I would go. Just to say I went.
Just to say I was there. Eileen started frequenting these parties at the ripe young age of 11, showing up with like ratty hair and wearing hand-me-downs that left her looking pretty disheveled. And as a result, boys virtually ignored her and refused to give her alcohol or cigarettes until Eileen started performing sexual favors for them. So then around, like, she's 11, just by the way, she became known around town as a sex worker, which, like, just as an aside, this basically set her up for, you know, viewing sex as a means to an end, which, you know, inherently causes intense psychological damage anyway. But with no support system around her, you know, she had very little self-worth until this started gaining her a certain reputation, which I assumed only made it worse. So... we can feel bad for young Eileen, but let's not feel bad for old Eileen. So besides for her grandmother, her brother Keith was the only other person in her life, and she began a sexual relationship with him. So the only two people in her life are basically her rapist enabling grandmother and her brother with whom she's in an incestuous relationship with. We are not setting up a foundation for success here. In 1970, at age 14, one of her grandfather's friends, because her grandfather would actively invite his friends over to abuse Eileen, one of her grandfather's friends actually raped Eileen and got her pregnant. This caused her to be mocked relentlessly in the town. She eventually sought relief at a woman's shelter where she gave birth to a baby boy who was just very quickly put up for adoption and never spoken of again. I tried to find something on him, but also, like, what little I found, I'm not going to mention because I don't know his life and I don't want to drag him into anything about this. Shortly after her return from the shelter, Britta actually unfortunately died of liver failure, obviously due to the alcoholism, which I'm sure that destroyed Eileen because they were very close. She repeatedly would run away from home, sleeping at bus stations or hitchhiking with strange men, you know, performing sexual acts in exchange for money. And this is when she sort of fully began supporting herself as a sex worker. Also at this time is when Eileen made her first real friend named Dawn Botkins. Now, despite her reputation, Dawn actually became very protective of Eileen. And Eileen explained to Dawn that she felt that everyone was, you know, out to get her, which Dawn, you know, somewhat agreed with. And she sort of took pity on Eileen, which at this point I do believe is true. You know, Eileen feeling like everyone's out to get her. I don't think that is a mental thing with her, even though, you know, she probably did have undiagnosed BPD, but everyone was in a one sense or another. So filled with this new confidence from her friendship with Dawn, Eileen took what little money she had and bought all the cigarettes and alcohol she could, and she threw a party, inviting everyone from the pits. Dawn remarked she had never seen Eileen as happy as she was at this party. However, once everyone had arrived, a group of boys grabbed her by the neck and threw her outside, locking her out where she could only watch her own party that she threw. So at this point is when she gave up on her hometown and everyone in it, which I honestly don't blame her at all. So in 1971, at 15 years old, also at this point, it's unclear. I read in some places that Lori actually kicked her and Keith out of the house. So this might have occurred then, or she might have just ran away. Unclear. At 15 years old, Eileen began hitchhiking and using sex work to pay. She landed in Colorado, where she found comfort in some of the local biker gangs that rode up and down the highway. Over the next few years, Eileen would have her fair share of run-ins with the law, none of which, ironically, were for sex work. And if you look on her Wikipedia page, you can find a whole bunch of just, like, things she did, you know, DUIs. I think at one point she was either arrested or, like, charged with firing a firearm out of, like, a moving vehicle. And you can just find a whole list of stuff she did. I didn't want to mention it because I figured it would get pretty, you know, pretty repetitive. But she did a bunch of bad stuff. Eileen would stand on the side of the highway a few hundred yards from an exit ramp and attempt to pick up clients. Men would pick her up in their car and pull off an exit where she would service them for as little as $30. However, her location and relatively, you know, inexpensive fee earned her a lot of repeat customers, and she would sometimes see 7 or 8 men per day going home with as little as $200. And as a teen, she would often sleep in the woods or abandoned cars using gas stations to shower. May 26th, I did mention one of these. May 26, 1978, 18-year-old Eileen was arrested in Jefferson County, Colorado for driving under the influence, disorderly conduct, and firing a .22 caliber pistol from a moving vehicle. She was later charged with failure to appear. I think this is the only one of her, like, crime things that I mentioned that wasn't, like, important to the case. Now, 1976, due to the relatively intense nature of her lifestyle, being that she, you know, basically lived outside, she hitchhiked down to Florida. In the spring, Eileen met a 69-year-old yachtsman named Louis Gratz Fell, and they married just a few months after meeting.
I mean,
you know,
that's how yachtsmen do it.
That is how yachtsmen do it. She continued to get in confrontations at the local bar and went to jail briefly for assault. She also hit Lewis with his own cane, leading him to file a restraining order against her just weeks after the wedding. As all good marriages start. July 14th, 1976, Eileen moved back to Michigan and was arrested and charged with disturbing the peace and assault for throwing a cue ball at a bartender's head. July 17th, Eileen's brother Keith unfortunately died of cancer at 21 years old. Eileen had no idea he was even sick, but she did receive $10,000 from his life insurance, and you can only guess where that money went. July 29th, Eileen and Lewis annulled their marriage after only 9 weeks. And August 1976, Eileen was arrested for drunk driving, and she used her brother's insurance money to pay the fine as well as purchase several other luxuries, including a car, which she promptly wrecked shortly afterward. She then returned to Daytona, Florida, and to her life of crime. So, time jump, it's 1981. At this point, Eileen was just completely out of touch with reality, choosing to self-medicate with alcohol and wearing just a bikini and without a getaway car. Eileen robbed a convenience store at gunpoint in Edgewater, Florida, stealing $35 and 2 packs of cigarettes. I will let you form the mental image of that. Actually, maybe don't.
That's not even the weirdest thing that happened that day in Florida. Like, I guarantee you.
Probably.
That would even make top 10.
Literally. Police found her easily, of course, and she was sent to prison on May 4th, 1982. She developed the same defensive reputation and really intense mood swings. She did, however, find solace in the company of other women in the prison. And this is where she was able to really, like, explore her sexuality. What you think of at this point, I don't think she ever really, like, came out and said anything about it. But you can only imagine the trauma that she has with men. So she may have felt like women were the only way to go and form a real relationship, though I don't know how much she was able to trust other women. She was released from prison at 27 years old on June 30th, 1983, and started going only by the name Lee. Though she returned to sex work and crime, she did begin to seek companionship with women. And by 1986, Eileen had met a 24-year-old hotel maid by the name of either Tyra or Tyria. I'm going to go with Tyra, and I think she goes by Ty now. I'm going to say Tyra. By the name of Tyra Moore at a Daytona Beach lesbian bar. The two quickly, quote-unquote, fell in love, and for the first couple years of the relationship, Eileen actually didn't display too much emotional instability. They lived together in a local rundown motel called the Fairview, where Tyra worked, and Eileen built up a sort of, like, purely, weirdly military client base to support them. In the late 80s, Eileen was in her 30s, and due to her alcohol use, her looks were starting to, you know, deteriorate. This caused her clients to disperse and also get deployed, and Eileen's income dropped drastically. She actually used pictures of her adoptive sister's children, which, by the way, I couldn't find anything about an adoptive sister, but she did use pictures of children that were not her own, claiming they were her own in order to win men's pity and sort of help her make ends meet. Tyra was, at this point, very clear that Eileen was not to come home until she brought home her share of rent for fear of losing the hotel room. Which brings us to November 30th, 1989. Eileen once again stepped out on the highway in search of work. A car did indeed pull over that Eileen didn't recognize. So she thought, oh, this could be another repeat customer, or this could be a new repeat customer. I could be getting some, you know, new money. The car belonged to 51-year-old electronics store owner Richard Mallory. They found a stretch of isolated road and pulled over. Little did Eileen know that Richard was actually just released from a 10-year prison sentence for sexual assault. Now, no one really knows what happened that night, because all of the information is coming straight from Eileen and in the interviews that she did. So, she said they both started drinking vodka and Richard, you know, began to change with the alcohol. He said he was a sadist and could only feel aroused if she was in pain. He then beat her, bound her hands, and tied her to the steering wheel of the car, saying, "You're going to do anything I want you to do, and if you don't, I'll kill you." He then assaulted and sodomized her. Eileen waited until Richard had gotten out of the car and moved towards the trunk to make her move. She escaped the bonds, grabbed the pistol from her bag, and shot Richard in the chest as he opened the passenger side door. And she figured the best thing to do was just to keep shooting him. She fired 3 more shots into his chest, one of which pierced his lung, killing him. And after dragging his body into the car, she grabbed the cash in his wallet and discarded it. Eileen drove Richard to a nearby junkyard, dumped his body under an old rug, and drove his car back to the hotel. She then brought Tyra outside, gave her the cash, and showed her their brand new car, displaying all of Richard's valuables on the hood. So this is what sort of makes me, like, a little bit iffy on her story, but I am not one to sit there and, you know, go, like, say anything about her interview or what she confessed to. Anyway.
I'm willing to chalk that one up to a good for her moment.
Yeah. And here's the thing. We're going to talk about this more later because I want to bring it up and I want to, you know, ask you what your thoughts are on it. But a lot of people say Eileen was unfairly treated and that she was sentenced to death for killing her rapist. If that is the case, which, and in my opinion, this first murder, absolutely. Absolutely, she was in the right. You know, I am going to go, like, we're going to look at her later MO and it absolutely makes sense that, you know, she had no problem with this until this moment and nothing was there to trigger her at this moment in time unless something like this happened. So I 100% believe, and obviously the fact that he just got out of prison for sexual assault, like, it makes sense. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's like, we're going to talk about it later, but this first murder, absolutely, I believe her that it was in self-defense. And like you said, a good for her moment. The later ones, not so much. Now, Tyra asked what happened, and Eileen confessed that she had murdered a client in self-defense. Now, later, Tyra admitted that Eileen's confession did scare her, but she didn't really know what to do, so she just asked Eileen that they never speak of it again. And she didn't want to know anything about any future murders. Though she kept the cash and valuables, Tyra worried the car would connect them to Mallory if police came. So they abandoned the Cadillac in some woods and they hiked home. The next morning, a deputy found the car containing Richard's wallet, unused condoms, and the empty bottle of vodka and filed a report. Nothing really came of it, as, you know, Richard was an ex-con and they just figured he was, like, off, hungover somewhere probably. On December 13th, 1989, though, a group of locals were searching the junkyard for scrap metal to sell when they came across a buzzard fixated on this old carpet. They then uncovered Richard Mallory's partially decomposed, blood-stained body. He was shirtless and his pants pockets were turned inside out and his hand had been picked at by a vulture. Which, now I'm just imagining the vulture, like, upturning his pants pockets.
Let me see what this dude's got in here.
Yeah.
Got any meat in here? Got any meat in there?
Now, given the fact his body had been moved, police actually figured the killer was a man motivated by robbery. And his case quickly went completely cold. Eileen began pawning off Richard's valuables at pawn shops, which she had to be ID'd for and thumbprinted for in case it turned up stolen. Let's all take that in. Yeah. Eileen agreed to do that. That is a surprise tool that will help us later. Mallory's money at this, like, was quickly running out for Eileen at this point. And Tyra was actually very apprehensive about Eileen prostituting and didn't approve of it because she believed it wasn't safe. However, Eileen wanted to give Tyra everything and provide for her for fear she would leave her like everyone else in her life. So as Eileen's funds were depleting, she began to panic and decided to go back to work with a new mentality about her clients. And so I'm guessing she just felt powerful when murdering Mallory and decided to benefit from taking power of men who she decided altogether had treated her badly and ignored her. Which we'll also see, she didn't take a cooling off period from this rape that she just experienced, which, you know, obviously may have contributed to her being triggered by these other clients and ragefully killing them before they could hurt her. And also, she made more money killing and stealing from Richard Mallory than she was than she would have made by just, like, just regular prostitution. So that could have been another contributing factor. June 1st, 1990, a surveyor called the police in Brooks County, Georgia, just across the Florida state line, saying he had come across a body. It was a white man, mid-40s, naked except for a baseball cap, with 6 bullet wounds in his chest from a .22 pistol, and a used condom was nearby. This, I don't remember if we say his name later. Oh, we do. Never mind. June 6th, 1990, another body was found in Pasco County. It was so badly decomposed, fingerprints couldn't be taken, and the coroner couldn't even estimate a time of death. It was determined that the 9 bullet holes in his chest were from a .22 caliber pistol. And I don't think we mention the name later, so I'm going to say it now. This was the body of Charles Karskadon, or Karskadon. I apologize. The detective for Pasco County, Tom Muck, notified the detective on Richard's Mallory's about the similarities in cases, and they just generally agreed to watch this closely. Muck also called the Georgia Bureau of Investigation, where he found out about their John Doe, and they began to connect the dots. So on June 7th, 1990, the Brooks County John Doe was identified as 47-year-old construction worker David Spears. He was declared missing on May 19th, 1990. Police had no idea how he got to Brooks County since it was 3 hours away from where he lived. In truth, Eileen had actually driven his body there in his own car, picked his pockets, and dumped him. And at this point, police still believe they were looking for a male killer motivated by robbery. So June 4th, we're going to go back a little bit. June 4th, 1990, two separate people witnessed a gray Pontiac Sunbird fly down the street until it eventually crashed into some brush. Tyra and Eileen emerged from the car. Eileen's arm was all bloody, and they were fighting with each other while drinking. The women then pushed the car back out onto the road, smashed windshield and everything, and they started driving again until the car completely broke down and they got out of the car and... Oh, sorry. I apologize. I made a typo. This was actually July 4th, 1990. The witness, seeing all of this happen, obviously called the police. And the responding officer spotted Eileen and Tyra walking away from the crash and rolled down his window, asking them if, you know, they were the ladies in the car crash. Eileen sort of snarled at him. So being obviously the police officer that, you know, does his job, of course, he rolled his window back up and returned to the car. And just, like, nothing else came of that. Which... The car was actually found to have blood stains all over the inside, including Eileen's palm print on the side. He called in the VIN and found that the vehicle was actually registered to a 65-year-old retired merchant seaman, Peter Seams, I believe it's pronounced. At the time, this man had been missing for over a month. And of course, after the fact, this officer connected that the two women he saw could have possibly been responsible for this man's disappearance, but they were gone, and the police labeled them as official suspects. Peter's body was actually never found. Now, July 30th, 1990, 50-year-old Troy Burris didn't show up to work, and he was reported missing the next day. At 4 a.m. the next morning, police found his car abandoned on the highway. His body was found on August 4th along a wooded area of State Road 19, shot twice. His wallet, credit cards, and receipts were found, but all of his cash had been taken. He was so unrecognizable, his wife was only able to identify him by his wedding band, which is just really sad. September 11th, 1990, 51-year-old Charles Humphreys was reported missing. His body was found the next day, fully clothed, shot in the head and torso 7 times. Now, while most of Eileen's other victims were suspected to have picked her up for sex work, Humphreys' family was adamant he would never do this. And obviously, you don't know exactly what he would do at this point. Like, a lot of people don't know these things. But his family, I just thought it was worth mentioning, was very adamant that he would not do that. November 17th, 1990, Eileen and Tyra got into a blowout fight, and Eileen was certain Tyra was going to leave her. She left for a bit to cool off, and a few hours later had picked up a client, 62-year-old Walter Antonio. She shot him 4 times and drove his naked body in the back of his car to a ditch where she dumped him. Police found his body the next morning, and Captain Steve Binegar immediately thought this had to be the same killer as the other 22 caliber murders. So this dude immediately put together a task force. And while police assumed the killer was a male hitchhiker, it was a bit odd because hitchhiking at this point was actually beginning to be viewed as more dangerous. So it was hypothesized that whoever got into these men's cars were not threatening in appearance. Binegar then remembered the 2 women responsible for crashing Peter Seam's car, and at the time, Peter was still missing, so Binegar set out to find them. By the end of November, police sketches of Eileen and Tyra had been distributed, and people were asking to send tips in about their whereabouts. And now, after seeing herself in the press, Eileen thought it was best to get rid of the murder weapon, so she threw her gun off a bridge. By mid-December, the police were informed of Tyra Moore's full name, though the informant only knew Eileen as Lee. On December 13th, Binegar got a call from police in Port Orange, Florida, who had been tracking Eileen and Tyra. They knew they were staying at the Fairview, though the women had left there previously, so they weren't there anymore. So, useless. But, turns out, after the police sketches were released, Tyra left Eileen, Pennsylvania. Now, at this point, the task force was back to square one until they started searching the pawn shops in search of the robbed items from the victims. This is where Binegar found Richard Mallory's camera with Eileen Warnos's fingerprint, which matched the print on Peter Seam's car. So, obviously, this is where we're gonna unravel.
It's all coming together.
Yeah. So, January 8th, 1991, Eileen was now depressed, homeless, and drinking her sorrows at the Last Resort Biker Bar in, I believe it's pronounced Volusia County? We're going to go with it. Now, sorry. 2 drug dealers named Bucket and Drums came up to her and made polite conversation and bought Eileen a beer. I laugh because, surprise, surprise, these were undercover police. And I just like to think that the police were, like, really racking their brains. What's a cool boss name I can make for my drum dealer alter ego?
What would you choose?
What would be my drug dealer alter ego?
If you were, like, a white man who is also a cop, I think I'd go with Kenneth.
Kenneth? Jeremy?
Chadwick?
Chadwick? Or like...
Abernathy?
I don't know. Abernathy? Abraham?
Yeah, you gotta hit him with the like, old president types.
I wouldn't go with Bucket and Drums, though, personally.
You know what? It takes a lot of confidence.
Imagine introducing yourself as someone. Hey, my name's Bucket. This is my pal Drums.
Bucket and Drums.
You know.
You would be Bucket.
You think I would
be Drums.
Okay. So.
we're changing the name of the podcast. It's actually the Bucket and Drums podcast.
So these guys, they reported back that they had made contact with Eileen. and the next morning she went back to the bar. The drug dealers from the previous night returned. Should I say, Bucket and Drums made their comeback. They bought Eileen another beer and brought her outside to smoke. The second she stepped outside, six officers pinned her to the ground and arrested her. Now, January 10th, 1990, two officers from the task force flew up to Pennsylvania to interview Tyra Moore. She confessed she did not know, or sorry, she did know the murders happened, but was adamant she knew nothing of them and, you know, consistently asked Eileen to never tell her about them. Which, Tyra, come on. Not saying, I mean, obviously, if you thought you were in love with her, I can see how that could cloud your judgment, but how are you going to talk to these police officers and say, yeah, I knew the murders happened, but because she didn't tell me anything about them, I thought it was okay. I don't know.
I think it's less of a, it was okay, and more of a, I didn't do it, though.
True, true.
I'm not saying it was right. All I'm saying is, I didn't do it.
Yeah. Well, since Tyra didn't have a record, police just glossed over her minimal involvement and offered her full immunity if she got Eileen to confess and testify against her. Tyra agreed, and the police put her up in a hotel in Daytona. Tyra told Eileen that the police were after her and she didn't know what to do. As Eileen was comforting Tyra, she asked if there was anyone else in the room with her. And when Tyra said no, Eileen told her to tell them everything they wanted to know and that she would cover for her because she wasn't going to let Tyra go to jail. The next day, Eileen confessed to all seven murders, including Peter Seam's body, who was not found yet. So over the next year, Warnos became a celebrity. She sold her story for hopes of making money, but, aw, gee, Florida state law actually prohibits prisoners from profiting from their crimes. Gosh darn it. That's sarcasm. I do not support criminals profiting from their crimes. Anyway, that was a legal statement. However, several police officers actually benefited very nicely from selling their stories from the case. So, we know where...
I hate to see police officers winning.
We know where their priorities lie. And her stories actually of the murders actually changed drastically over time. So that's what kind of bit iffy and probably a testament to her mental health. Even though Eileen confessed to all of her murders, police could really only nail her on Richard Mallory based on the physical evidence. But strangely, in her initial taped confession, she never mentioned Richard Mallory raping her. This could possibly be because she was worried and she needed to clear Tyra, but I just thought it was important to mention. Do I think Richard Mallory raped her? I do, because that is the most plausible and just makes the most sense. She repeatedly, during these interviews, you know, quieted her public defender and said, quote, I took a life. I am willing to give up my life because I killed people. I deserve to die. So January 14th, 1992, Eileen went to trial. The media had dubbed her at this point the damsel of death. Her trial lasted about 2 weeks. So in Florida, a defendant convicted of murder can receive the death penalty if the murder, it's a bunch of like these circumstances, but relevant to this case, the defendant can be convicted of murder or like receive the death penalty if the murder has been committed under circumstances falling under capital murder, one of which being, I believe, the murder of two or more people. Warnos was charged with the first degree murder of Richard Mallory, armed robbery with a firearm or deadly weapon, and possession of a firearm by a convicted felon. The prosecution obviously painted her as an evil, violent woman and challenged her original stories that she murdered all these men in self-defense. They based their case mainly on the videotaped confessions, but they were also allowed to introduce evidence related to her other murder charges based on a Florida law called the Williams Rule, which actually allows evidence related to collateral crimes to be admitted if it helps to show motive, intent, knowledge, modus operandi, or lack of mistake. So at this point, it was easy to completely overlook Eileen's case of self-defense as she seemed to tell different stories with each interrogation. The state then called Tyra Moore to the stand. Tyra testified that Eileen was dangerous and that she lived in fear of her. And for the entirety of Tyra's testimony, Eileen looked at her hands, and I can't imagine if she thought she was in love with her. I can't imagine the shock and just like the pain she must have felt from seeing like another person betray her. And I just can't imagine. And this is where I think she was failed. Not obviously as a murderer, but just as a person. So despite the consensus that Eileen suffered from BPD, it was concluded she did know the difference from right and wrong. And after debating for about 2 hours, Eileen was found guilty on all counts and sentenced to death. Later that year, Eileen recanted her confession and said all of her murders were motivated by robbery. So this is obviously where she sort of went off the rails. She waived her rights to any appeals, and she spent the next 10 years on death row. She slowly began to lose it, spouting conspiracies, and was worried to be having a psychotic break. So this delayed her execution, and she was examined by 3 psychiatrists who concluded she was mentally stable. I'm just going to let you guys form your own opinions on that. So in 2002, Governor Jeb Bush lifted Florida's temporary stay of execution and signed her death warrant. Eileen was interviewed the morning before her death. She seemed okay and in high spirits, mentioning several times that she was okay with it. When asked if she had been betrayed by everyone she trusted, she responded that yes, she was. And that's why she didn't care if she was executed, which is very sad. I don't feel bad for her, but that's a sad statement.
Why did he lift it? Just public pressure to do so?
That's what I'm assuming. I'm assuming it was public pressure. And also, this was a huge case at the time. So that's my best guess. But she then spun off into a conspiracy that she was set up to be allowed to continue killing by the police to clean up the streets and then be arrested and labeled as a serial killer and make money off of her life rights. She also claimed the police were torturing her through sonic waves coming from her mirror that were squeezing her skull and sending shock waves through her body when she tried to tell the truth. Again, I will let you form your own opinions on the mentally stable verdict that she was given.
I believe it.
Yeah.
I think she's telling the truth.
The next morning, on October 9th, 2002, Eileen was led to a room in the prison with only a gurney and a black phone. She, a number of guards, and an executioner waited for the phone to ring for another stay of execution, which never came. Eileen's last words were, "Yes, I would just like to rock and I'll be back, like Independence Day with Jesus. June 6th, like the movie. Big mothership and all, I'll be back." By 9:47 a.m., Eileen Wuornos was dead. Now, today, Eileen Wuornos is generally labeled as a monster, though she has garnered a weird cult following. Many people champion her for standing up against her abusers, and she said she did it all in self-defense. Where I got the idea to do this case, because back when men were going around saying that some day was like International Rape Day or whatever, people were posing like Eileen saying, "This is going to be me on like this day," which is like, and there's a bunch of videos saying, you know, give this woman an apology. The government failed this woman. And there's so many people glorifying Eileen Wuornos. And it's like, don't. It's like, do not glorify Eileen Wuornos. There's nothing about her to glorify. If it was just the Richard Mallory murder, yes, I would say everyone failed her. But from then on, she murdered for money, and she murdered because it was more convenient than prostitution. So it's harmful to say that, I feel. I mean, what do you think?
I would agree. Definitely nothing to glorify. I don't know. I do kind of agree that everybody failed her. She was definitely set up for failure. I feel like nowadays we would have definitely maybe tried to take like an institution route in place of death penalty. Not necessarily because like we would feel bad for her, but because I think a lot of people would want to see like why she does what she does. Kind of a thing, because like with a backstory like that, you know, it's something other than it's more convenient than a prostitute. Like, there's definitely building blocks of causes and effects that all built up to multiple moments of her committing crimes. So I don't know if she would have been, like, executed if this had happened, like, a decade later.
Yeah. And it's also important to mention prostitution was illegal at this time. So that could have been another, like, reason to pull forward a guilty verdict.
You're saying it like it's not now.
Well, yes, true. But it was, but now, nowadays we have a, most people have a more, like, open-minded view of sex work. At least, like, with the idea of sex work, I would, you know, sort of wager saying. But back then it was, like, very much, you know, you were a dirty person.
I would argue against you on this one, only because the kind of sex work that people are comfortable with now is not the kind of sex work that was being performed by Eileen Wuornos and still today people in similar, like, life situations as her. The kinds that are more socially acceptable today are, like, having an OnlyFans account.
Yeah.
Doing, like, a happy ending at a massage parlor or something in, like, a club or area specifically dedicated to this. And it's usually, like, yes, a white woman, but not someone who has been through, like, well, and there's always the joke, like, fatherless behavior, you know, she had a rough childhood, but, like, when it's shown as someone like Eileen, who is literally on the side of the road, just hoping for the best, making under $200 a day on a good day, that's not what we're anywhere near comfortable with. And I would even say people don't even like to think about it.
True. Okay. Yeah, I can. Yeah. Okay. You've like, turned me over to your side.
I think we would have the same opinion of her today as we did then. And even people today who are like, oh yeah, like, sex work is real work, because of course it is, like, I totally agree with that, but I would not say that all of those people would show the same sympathy, empathy, and understanding for her as they do to, like, the struggling college student who is a cam girl to, like, help pay her way through college. Like,
yeah.
She's never had, like, Eileen never had a real job. Like, abused since, like, conception. Like, even conception was not great. Like,
yeah.
Really from beginning to end, nothing but peril.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, parents, terrible. Even if her brother was a good person, it's not like he's blameless either. So, like, mm-hmm. Any member of the family tree, she never really, like, Dawn was her friend, but, like, that didn't really end up too well. Like, so everyone in the town where she was born, she never really got any other friends. And even Tyra was, like, willing to take it, which, like, I don't know, I probably would do the same thing in her place, but still, like,
yeah.
It was just set up for failure.
I guess the point I'm trying to make is do not glorify Eileen Wuornos in the case of do this. I am all for empowering victims of sexual assault and sexual abuse. Of course I am. But do not sit there and say you're going to be like Eileen Wuornos if this happens, because you have to research your case. You have to know that it was one instance, which I believe, yes, she was justified if that is the story, which I do believe that is the story, and the other ones just, you know, either triggered her and she took the best out of it. But the other murders, they were, you know, innocent men to my knowledge and to everyone else's knowledge. So don't sit there and say, you know, you're going to be like Eileen Wuornos to your abuser, because that just is obviously, she had a horrible life, a horrible childhood. Nurture, obviously, I believe played a huge, huge part in this whole thing. But point is, don't glorify serial killers. please don't do that.
No, it's like I said before. First one, definitely good for her moment. Who knows what that did to her mentally, physically. Like, that could have been a trigger that triggered all the other ones. Or could have just blacked out for the whole thing and then never thought about it again.
Mm-hmm.
Like, people I have do different believe responses to different things. But,
yeah.
No. I don't know. I think the only reason that her case would have gone differently in the present day is because people would have wanted to understand her better. Like, she would have only lived to pretty much serve the purpose of us, like, finding out what is, quote-unquote, like, wrong with her. Like, mm-hmm. bad phrases, but just to be like, okay, like, there has to be a reason why you're doing this. Like, and obviously you had a terrible childhood, but, like, let's see what, perhaps, like, mental illnesses or disorders this gave you. How can we, like, explain what you did? And it might have been explainable or it might not have been, but I think that is the only thing that would have gone differently, because police haven't really gotten better at anything, so.
Yeah. True.
I think it would have been a choose-your-own-adventure where it's only the last, like, two pages that you can change.
Yeah, true.
Everything else, you could have told me that this happened 2 years ago, and I would have believed you.
True. So, couple more things about her. After her execution, she was cremated, and her remains were sent back to Troy, Michigan, to her childhood friend, Dawn Botkins. And Dawn has done a couple of interviews after the fact, saying she just kind of, you know, at this point, I do believe Dawn actually talked to her while she was in prison. And at this point, she was like, I just tried to see past it and see my friend again. And you can watch a bunch of interviews with her. It's really interesting. But Dawn scattered her remains underneath her walnut tree in her backyard. And also, just to ruin this song for you, Eileen requested the song Carnival by Natalie Merchant be played at her funeral. Because she would listen to the album Tiger Lily a lot, just as a fun fact. But there have been, of course, many documentaries and films about Eileen Wuornos. She wrote a book, I believe, with another person, and I'm going to look him up right now because I stupidly did not write his name down.
Man, it must have been wild to be Dawn. Like, out of everybody who is still, like, alive at that time, it must have been wild to, like, if she did speak to her in jail, like, to just, like, look at where her life went and, like, probably not even be surprised.
Imagine being any of her previous clients. Like, I doubt anyone, like, would remember her, but, like, yeah. Imagine it. So, Eileen Wuornos actually wrote a book with Christopher Barry D called Monster. Monster, My True Story. I did not have the chance to read it before I did this case because I couldn't find it anywhere. I do want to read it. But Eileen Wuornos did appear in American Horror Story Hotel. She was played by Lily Rabe, who I think did a good job. But the most famous, by far, portrayal of Eileen Wuornos is the movie Monster, starring Charlize Theron and Christina Ricci. So, just a fun fact, Charlize gained between, like, 20 and 30 pounds and shaved her eyebrows for the role. And Christina gained 20 pounds, thought it was a fun fact. But I finished this movie this morning. It is absolutely incredible. It is fantastic. It is so, so good. They did a fantastic job. Charlize Theron won an Academy Award for this movie, and she 100% deserves it. She was phenomenal. She was scary good at portraying Eileen. I had watched a couple videos of her just for the case, and she nailed her. She embodied her, and it's so crazy to watch. The movie does a really good job of riding that fine line of, do you feel bad for Eileen or do you see her as a monster? And I thought it was just so incredible. I cried at the end, not because I feel bad for her, but just because it was such a powerful film. And also, midway through the movie, I was like, which, by the way, it follows Eileen and her girlfriend Selby, which is based off of Tyra Moore. But Christina Ricci plays Selby, and I was like, this girl looks really familiar. And I was like, who is this woman? It's Wednesday from the Addams Family.
Yeah.
Which, she looks the same. Like, she aged, and she still looks like a child. And I mean that not in a bad way, but just, like, she doesn't age. But everyone, go watch the movie. It was also hard because I was writing this case while I was watching the movie. Not at the same time, but I was just sort of doing it at the same period of time. It was hard. It was hard because I was like, I was in her mindset and I was seeing all of this portrayed. And I had to pause the movie a couple times because it was difficult. They did do the Richard Mallory scene very well, I would say. Not well as in like it's a good scene, but they did it in like a no like BS, like it was real, it was raw, it was terrifying, and I think they did a really good job with it, and I appreciate that they did that, they showed it for what it is. But I'll stop talking about the movie. I just wanted to say how good it was. And if you're interested in this case, I highly recommend you go watch this movie. It's hard, but it's really good. Try to power through the difficult scene. But as recently as March 16th, 2021, Voltage Pictures acquired the rights to a film called American Boogie Woman, which we'll move past the name. I'm assuming, I don't know if American Boogeyman, which is a movie either out soon or filming now, but it's another freaking Ted Bundy movie that we don't need. Stop making movies about Ted Bundy. But
I don't know why people like latched onto him the way that they did. I don't know
why people care.
I will never really understand why I feel like watching like people made more TV shows and more movies about Ted Bundy is the same way that I feel when you walk into like any store nowadays and there's all those band shirts with like AC/DC and Led Zeppelin and like Pink Floyd, and you're like, what are you even doing here? Like, yeah. Why are you still doing this?
Yeah.
Like, how is it's this like somehow like back in style again? Like, I don't know why people have fixated on him as like the one, maybe because they were like, he's so normal and attractive and he's like everybody else, but it's like
he's not attractive.
Like, one, he's crusty. He looks like he smells like pool water, even though he doesn't look like he could swim. But like, yeah. I don't know. Like, maybe people are just like, it really proves that it can just be a regular neighbor. But it's why haven't you latched onto any of the other ones? Like, just because you personally might think that somebody looks a little creepy, so therefore, of course, they're a serial killer. Like, yeah. Why him? I don't understand.
Yeah, I do. And Dahmer was really good. Did we watch that together?
Yeah.
Yeah, my friend Dahmer, I thought, was really good just because it sort of, like, gave... I do think obviously continuously making movies about these serial killers sort of glamorizes them in a way, of course. But I think movies like My Friend Dahmer and this one are, I don't want to say important, but they're certainly not contributing something of value to see these played out in real time, especially with Monster and showing everything how real it is. I believe it's very important. But I don't have a problem with that. But like things like this Ted Bundy movie, like the Ted Bundy tapes on Netflix are really good. And that's obviously a documentary, but like Extremely Wicked, Shockingly Evil and Vile, bad movie because it didn't do the case right. And I don't think it did what it set out to do. And it wasn't necessary. Like,
I don't know. Like, I'm okay with them in a documentary because that's just like, that's like doing research, but like instead of reading, you're watching. Like, it's just a different way to learn about the same thing. I don't really like when people make a lot of like movie or TV show content about it that's just like to tell the story, because then it just slides right into like horror slasher genre where like people are free to obviously like over exaggerate things like for the screen, which that's what you do for a movie. But I feel like that's where it starts to tiptoe more of the like glamorizing again, because then, I mean, people thirst over scenes from Scream to this day. You're one of them. Like,
I saw a fan edit of Richard Ramirez like the other day.
I think it's hard.
Mm-hmm.
Like, but just the line.
Yeah.
That.
Mm-hmm. But they acquired the rights to this film, American Boogie Woman. It's going to be coming out September 20th this year. It is a prequel to Monster, playing Eileen Wuornos. I will give you a hint.
I know who it is, and I cannot like produce it.
Peyton List from like Jesse, like Disney Channel's Jesse. Look. I don't know how it's going to turn out, okay? I don't think we needed a prequel to this movie at all, but It's happening, and maybe I'll watch it.
I do remember reading those Peyton list, and I think my only problem with it is that her facial structure is much more, like, round, and I don't know, like, what they'll do with it, makeup, SFX-wise.
Yeah, she's very pretty, but Charlize Theron, like, looked like Eileen.
Yeah, like, I feel like you gotta get, like, they gotta make her gaunt and, like, you know, like, she's been drinking since, like, the womb.
Yeah, it's, but they gotta, like, I don't know what they're gonna do, but anyway, that is the very hard and heavy case of Eileen Wuornos. I obviously, as I say with all my cases, I thought it was important to cover, and I'm actually quite proud of this one. I'm proud of the work I did, and I hope I did a good job with her story.
You did.
Thank you.
In my unprofessional, unremarkable opinion.
Thank you. Well, I will be posting photos of Eileen. I will be posting photos of, I'm sure, the victims, possibly Tyra, and everything else on our Instagram at BloodGutsPod. You can follow us on Twitter at Blood_GutsPod. You can email us your stories of, like, maybe you have some weird connection to this case, or you have a ghost story, or just anything fun. If you want to email us anything fun, we would love to do a listener stories episode. Our email is bloodgutspod@gmail.com. And do you want to do a PSA for this case?
Sure. Being able to recognize that someone could be classified as a monstrous for doing monstrous things, and also having the capacity to feel bad for them, are not mutually exclusive things. You are able to do both, and sometimes you should. But the most important thing to remember is perspective, and also the weight of one action above another. It is entirely possible to look at Eileen Wuornos' life and recognize that her childhood, adulthood, entire life really sucked. Everybody was totally out to get her. She was totally justified in feeling that way. And no part of her life is something that most people will ever be able to comprehend. And for that, I do truly feel bad for her. But it is also very important to look at actions that she has taken, whether it be from, like, mental illness, a disorder, being triggered, something like that, or just from because she wanted to, that those are monstrous things. And it is important to draw the line between feeling bad for someone for having an unfortunate life and then using it to excuse actions that are inexcusable.
Very well said.
Thank you.
I appreciate that. And as Ash and Elena over at Morbid Podcast say all the time, feel bad for the young version of serial killers that had tragic childhoods. Do not feel bad for post-murder conviction and death penalty serial killers. And don't glorify them on TikTok. Don't make fan edits. They're not worth it. None of them are attractive. Please stop.
Yeah. Ugh. The only thing that I will allow pass for is the American Horror Story version of Richard Ramirez.
Valid.
That's it. And that's only because, like, it is a portrayal of him, but also not really at all.
Yeah.
Like, you're allowed to do it when it's a not really at all. But whether it's a documentary or, like, an inspired by, you're not allowed to do that, okay?
Mm-hmm. And for the brief portion that Lily Rabe was Eileen Wuornos on Hotel, I thought she did a really good job.
Oh, I agree.
Mm-hmm. But, yeah, hope you found this case interesting and entertaining and insightful. And we will see you for the next bloody case that we eventually cover.
Yeah, you opened this with regularly scheduled, and I was like, well, maybe in our hearts.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Bye, everyone.
Goodbye.